The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we're going to get a little bit caught up on, I guess, personal events. I'm finally back from Vietnam, so we'll chat a little bit about that. We've also got a couple of articles about some recent tax rulings that will kind of show you some things to maybe do or not do with your IRA.
Not do.
Mostly not do. And then if we've got some time, we will maybe discuss a few more of the things that Ed Slott shares with us, at least shares with Jim at the... I guess they're biannual, right? You or semi-annual? You go twice a year?
I do, but this year I'm torn.
You are.
Well, I was all set to go. It's the end of October mm-hmm. until a friend of mine. We were out shooting pool just a few days ago, and he said he's going to see Bob Seger. And I said I always wanted to see Bob Seger, mm-hmm. so he had two tickets and no girlfriend anymore. Mm-hmm. So. He offered me his other ticket.
And it overlaps with Ed Slott?
It is day two of the Ed Slott event.
Mm, and not in the same city?
No. Denver and Kansas City.
Oh, those are fairly close.
You can
fly out.
I like Seger, but I don't like him that much. So I'm not sure. I'm going home in a couple of weeks, so we'll have Junior on the show recording with you when I'm not here. But when I go home to Boston... the first 2 days, I'm going to go to Ed Slott's, what he calls his two-day event. So I'll be there on...
How many events does he put on?
A lot. So our events are 3 days, and they're only available to people in his program. The two-day events are available to anybody. But they're a good overview. It's just a good refresher course. Mm-hmm. And he lets advisors in his program go for free. We don't have to pay. So I figure, well, heck, since I'm going to be home anyways, I might as well go. So between...
Is that an excuse to get out of spending time with your mother?
No, not at all. I'm just going to do 2 days of training with Ed and then...
Aren't you going home to see your mother and maybe
I will.
Your sister?
I'll be with them for 5 days. How many more days do you want?
I'm just wondering because it seems like
five's
you're planning a lot of hours away from them.
No. Five with them.
Okay.
Two with Ed.
Oh, five plus two?
I'll be gone a week.
So you're not using... Two of your 5 days, you've got 7 days.
I have 7 days total.
Oh, that's not too bad, I guess.
No.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's neither here nor there. So it may be annual if I decide Bob Seger is more important.
But he's just recently come back, 2 months ago? And we still haven't divulged all the fantastic information that Ed shared with you last time.
Oh, I thought you meant Bob Seger just came back 2 months ago. I was like, well, was he sick?
No, the whole reason we're talking about this is we're talking about divulging information from the Ed Slott program to our listeners.
True. But why don't you, and welcome.
But if you go to Bob Seger, we'll want to hear about that when you come back.
I just like Seger. I grew up with him. But Anyways, this is the Retirement and IRA Show. I want to welcome everyone. You've only heard my voice for the past month, as well as Justin's and Peter Scott's. Mm-hmm. We dragged Pete kicking and screaming out of retirement one day.
Yeah.
But
how'd
Chris,
that go?
It went well.
I wasn't able to listen.
We had, he answered one email question quite thoroughly. A gentleman who has been diagnosed with dementia and was concerned about the 10% early withdrawal penalty because he had to take money out of his retirement account to live on. That to me was the easy part. There is no 10% penalty for disability, and he worked for the federal government, and with his dementia, they put him on disability. So he won't have a 10% penalty. But I was much more concerned with being in his mid-50s with early onset dementia. There was so many other things he had to pull together. Yeah. So Pete came on and did a wonderful job. At least I think he did a wonderful job answering that question. Mm-hmm. Junior did well in your absence. He came on the show a few times. But you need to bring us up to date. I want to welcome everybody to the Retirement IRA Show. Of course, our iTunian listeners, you're listening at any time. Our Northern Colorado listeners, today is what, Chris? Today is
July
the 5th,
but
it's going to be
5th.
The 8th.
Be the 8th when this show plays.
Right. We're recording it on the 5th. It's going to play live for our Northern Colorado listeners on July 8th. So good morning to them, and welcome again to the Retirement and IRA Show. We've got some good topics, but before we jump into some IRA topics, there was a couple of tax court rulings that came out recently, really on things not to do with your IRA. On both these cases, Chris, if people were regular listeners to this show, I don't think they would have been. Well, one guy got burned. The other guy kind of won. And so it's not every day we win when the IRS says we owe money. He fought the IRS in court. He fought the law, and he won, not the law.
Excellent.
To borrow from...
It's encouraging to know that it happens occasionally.
But maybe we should play the Rocky theme when we review this tax court case, because he did win. He beat the IRS. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to get into a little more of the Ed Slott stuff. But before we begin any of that... this is not bantering, so iTunians, please don't get mad at us.
It's kind of bantering.
I want Chris to tell us a little bit about his trip to Afghanistan.
What?
Not Afghanistan.
A little farther back. Vietnam.
No, Vietnam. Thank you. Yes. Wrong war.
Yeah, wrong war.
Where the hell did I get Afghanistan
from? I don't know,
because
we haven't talked about that at all.
Well, you know what it is? I was just reading the article of a soldier who died in Afghanistan, so I think that keyed off of my mind. But anyways, he's not in Afghanistan. He was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. For 5 weeks, which is a long time.
And no one shot at you?
No, I got spit on once.
Okay, well, you can tell us about that.
The guy was a little deranged, I think.
Was he a Vietnam vet?
Could have been. He was old.
Yeah, maybe.
But he had kind of a crazy look in his eye. So,
well, maybe he was a Viet Cong vet.
Could have been.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Chris is going to bring us up to date on his trip to Vietnam, but more importantly, what he learned about the Vietnamese retirement system. So maybe you could just enlighten our listeners, take 5, 7, 8, 10 minutes, not too much, because iTunians will start yelling at us for bantering. But I don't really think this is bantering. This is more educational.
Yeah, I will say that the more interesting part of the trip wasn't really what I found out about the retirement system, because there isn't actually a lot of information, nor do the Vietnamese workers themselves seem to know a whole lot of detail about it, other than they have an established social insurance program, so essentially the equivalent of our social security system, where the government does provide a small amount for retirees to people. I could never get any, either they didn't know or they weren't willing to tell me how much it was, other than to say it was a small amount. So in their eyes, it isn't something where they're just totally taken care of, all their problems
and
go
away.
And
do they get it at a certain age, like 65, 70?
It seemed to be when they were unable to work anymore. So I'm not sure there was a set age. And again, I couldn't find any official government documentation on this. And the things that I thought might have been government documentation were in Vietnamese, so they were a little hard for me to understand. But I figured it would be easier, and I came to be wrong, to just ask people who were working, who had parents that were maybe retired, about what they get. And all they knew was, oh, the government just sends them a little bit of money every month, and they also have some savings, but there wasn't a lot of organized retirement plans or anything like that. People could have saved money, but most of the time it was in the bank, or it's very popular these days for them to invest in businesses. So it's not really, I think, through an organized financial market like the stock exchange, but rather they contribute money to someone who's opening a restaurant or opening a tour guide service or buying a car it's very popular to drive private cars like Uber. They do have Uber there, but the more popular service is something called Grab, which is, I think, started in Indonesia or the Philippines. That is more of an Asian-centric version of Uber. And a lot of seeming to be young males have their own private cars, and they make money by driving essentially for Uber or their equivalent over there. And but they really didn't know a lot of details about how only, and I think it's because it's such a small amount, they realized that that's not, they need to plan on other things. And that other thing turned out to be their family taking care of them. So it is common. I think it's most people realize that it's a lot of Asian cultures and others around the world will have multi-generational households where you've got grandparents in there and then a set of adults and then even the grandkids, sometimes even four generations under one roof. But it's very common to have three generations all living in the same house. And from what I could figure out, that was really one of the main parts of their retirement plan, which is to have a piece of real estate paid for, to have a home that the family could stay in. And it was generally owned by the oldest generation. So it would be the grandparents' home that they had somehow saved enough money over time to buy the house. And then the younger generation was kind of allowed to live there for two reasons. One, because it was really expensive to buy a house, particularly in the city. So they couldn't really afford it, so they kind of lived at home out of necessity. But the expectation was we would, as the oldest generation, we would provide housing for you in exchange for you taking care of us. So and the houses typically over there, and this is a bit fascinating, they're usually very vertical, very narrow houses and very vertical. And that came to be, and this is purely a proof that government policy and tax policy can drive human behavior. The property taxes were a function of the width of the property, the width of the house.
Not the total square
foot. Not the square footage, not how much land it takes up, not the height. It's the width. So they made them as narrow as possible. So most of these houses are maybe 10 feet wide.
No.
Serious. But are three or four stories tall and really deep. Might be 40 to 60 feet deep.
How do you get, I mean, what's a hallway?
Well, very narrow, which is can happen when you have a very small sized population.
So you don't really have a big room.
No. But, I mean, kind of deep and narrow. But it's very uncommon. You'd be a very rich person if you had what we would consider to be the shape of a house we have here. Some of that in the newer subdivisions that I saw could be slightly changing. But for many, many years, they've had this policy, at least in the, I was mostly in Hanoi, but even when I went out to villages that were outside, it was the same little narrow buildings. Everything built out of concrete, first of all, but these tall, narrow, which wasn't real, and I looked at that because there's stairs everywhere. It's the least ADA compliant place I've ever seen in my life. You couldn't function there in a wheelchair. It's just, they must institutionalize people that need assistance because you couldn't get around the sidewalks. There was no such thing as what we think of as a crosswalk where you'd have a safe area to cross. The sidewalks were bumpy and had holes, and it would just be impossible. And every entrance to everywhere was stairs.
So it's a trials attorney dream come true.
Well, if they had such a thing. Yeah. But back to the multi-generational household, I did confirm this on the main floor so they wouldn't have to go up and down the stairs. That's where the
older people live,
and then the young people live upstairs. And as you age, then you would move down the floors of the house so that you were eventually on the main floor so that you didn't have to go up and down the stairs. Although I will tell you, because of the amount of walking they do and the limited amount of sugar that they take in, they're all very thin and healthy, even old people. I saw people that were pushing 100 years old probably, still walking around and doing their thing. So it's a little different situation than here in the United States.
Interesting.
Right?
Very interesting.
So, but that's kind of their retirement plan, and it's expected, particularly of the oldest male child, that their main responsibility is to make sure that their parents are taken care of, and then they get the house. So when they pass away, that's the payoff, I guess, for you get to live there while they're alive. And then
so the second born and beyond, they get screwed.
Sometimes that's, and I asked him about that, and they said it is kind of challenging sometimes that sometimes it's understood and everything's fine, that if the oldest, because they took care of the parents, it was their reward to get the house. But if you had siblings in there, and there's not a lot of large families, but if you had siblings, one or maybe two siblings, sometimes it ends up being like we have here where the house has to be sold and then split up. But apparently it causes a lot of friction in certain families, and that's becoming more and more common. But yeah, that's their plan for the most part.
Hmm.
Now, this will be challenged, I think, over time because more and more kids are moving away from their parents. In the past generations, it was common for the kids to always just stick around. Wherever you were born, you grew up, and you stayed there.
Well, especially the second, third, and fourth born, there's no reason to stay around if they're not going to get the house.
Well, sometimes they all live there.
One person owns it, but everyone's living there.
Everyone's living there. Then you've got, but now there's this migration from the rural areas into the cities where there's more job opportunities and much higher paying jobs and a lot higher standard of living and that sort of thing. So you're seeing now all these kids move away, leaving parents behind with no one to take care of them. And I think they're going to start to see a lot of pressures on this traditional approach that they've got. And I'm not sure how they're going to handle that because there aren't, the state is there to provide basic medical care, and there's the Social Security aspect and that sort of thing, and a lot of assistance programs. But I think everyone, including the government, relied upon this traditional way of younger people taking care of their parents. So the government didn't have to step in and spend money to do this because the kids did it. That was part of their contribution to society, is they took care of the older generation. As they become migrating around the country and they get separated, this is going to become a problem. I don't know who's going to take care of the older people when they can't take care of themselves anymore. So
interesting.
Maybe they'll be this forced, well, I have to quit my job in the city and move back and take care of the folks kind of situation, which is probably going on now. But I do know, instead of a 50-50 split, when you work for a private company, two-thirds of their equivalent to Social Security, two-thirds is paid by the company, one-third is paid by the employee. So it's not quite how we have it here, which is essentially a 50-50 split as contributions to their Social Security system. It's a two-third, one-third instead.
Okay. Interesting. And outside of that unique aspect, the retirement part, how did your teaching go?
The teaching went pretty well. I taught a four-week class, and it was 2 hours a day in the morning. Turns out I had it structured so that I would teach for 4 days, and then they would be tested on Fridays. That would made it nice for me because then we could go off and go on excursions and stuff over the three-day weekend, so we got to see a lot of cool stuff on the weekends. The good students, even when I would mention to people out as I met them and they were wondering what the heck I was doing in Vietnam and I told them where I was teaching, they would recognize the place and say, oh, that's a very prestigious university. So it's very, I'd heard it was very competitive to get in and you had to be top of your class to get there. So I knew the students would be good, and they proved to be good, and the best students there were every bit as good as the best students we have here. What was a little disappointing is they've got it's very, very competitive. So there's this push or pressure to be the top of the heap. So there's a lot of temptation to try to cheat, and apparently there's a fair amount of parents paying either instructors or administration to improve their grade on their transcript. So that was a little disheartening. To see that.
Now, can you say that?
I just did.
Okay.
I've escaped the country, so they can't. Now maybe I can't go back after saying that. But I don't know how deep it is or how many, but it's clearly going on to some extent. It was admitted to me that there was this this happens over there. So that's too bad. And, you know, and there's cheating that goes on here, too. So it's not like Western universities are pristine and everyone follows the
rules.
What
are you saying about CSU?
Well, CSU, occasionally we've got somebody who cheats. And I would say I would be shocked if we found an institutionalized version of someone could pay to get your grade improved. That would shock me, especially at CSU. I can't speak to any other university, but that would be shocking at most Western universities. Apparently, and it wasn't unique to this, that in a lot of Asian countries, this was, because I asked him, you know, is this common? Oh, yeah, unfortunately, it kind of happens. And it's the wealthier families that want to make sure their kids have a shot at a good job. And so the expectation is you come out in the top, 10%, and no matter how you get there, you got to be there. So that was a bit of a bummer, but the kids were great. The students were good. The students were talented and could do all the work. So it wasn't like they were not worthy. That's the frustrating thing, is they could do it and absolutely can handle the material and learn the material. So they can do what it takes to succeed. So they don't need to do anything. They don't need to cheat or try to take these shortcuts, but it still went on. It wasn't. So the good news is, I guess, it's not like these people that shouldn't be in a position are getting there. They deserve to be there. They just should have gotten there without any, shortcuts. So that was, good and bad. Students were good, very respectful, good questions, happy. They're, for the most part, when you wander around, it's a very happy society. The big city where we were, it's very typical of a big city. People are kind of doing their own thing, and they don't really engage with you unless you start it. If you start them, then they'll talk to you and interact with you happily. But kind of just like if you go to a big city here in the United States, everybody's kind of doing their thing, and they're not really looking at you a whole lot, and they're not smiling and saying hi. But when you go out into the smaller towns, they're just like here. When you go to a smaller town, people wave at you, people smile, say hi. So that part is the same. Most of the younger people could speak some English. Most of the older people didn't. But you could kind of get by with basic words and pointing.
Did you use Google Translator?
I did have that on my phone, and occasionally if I needed one specific word to try to get something across, I would pull it up on there and show it to them or have the phone pronounce it, and then they would get it.
And
so it wasn't too bad being able to communicate.
Socially, I'm just curious, did you eat anything that we normally would have sprayed with Raid, composted, or put in a garbage disposal?
Lots of stuff probably that would end up in a garbage disposal. I didn't knowingly eat bugs, but I'm sure there were some here and there because the sanitary standards are not what we expect here. But I knew that going in.
But I didn't know if they had like fried crickets and mealworms and everything. Those are the...
I don't think so. But there's some things we would eat that we were being served in kind of a family style. They just bring out a bunch of different kinds of dishes that might have been something strange. But I don't think we ate anything. They did have strange things there. Not in a standard restaurant. Most of the standard restaurants, it was all straight up, and they'd have the standard chicken, beef, and pork. They eat a lot of pork there, so a lot of pork dishes, and seafood as well. But there were some places, if you wanted to, you could go, and they would specialize in weird things, different types of snakes and spiders and caterpillars and things like that. We didn't go there.
Yeah.
Because remember, I had a bunch of kids with me, too. True. Not that I would really want to go and try that stuff myself. But,
yeah, I wouldn't want to either.
And the food is kind of an adventure. It's some things, it was hard to, they didn't know the English word for what it is, which concerned me a little bit. But as long as it looked like something somewhat identifiable, we would try it. And there's something that I've termed the Hanoi diet, which is you can lose weight. You lose weight going there, especially as a Westerner, because you're kind of constantly in a state of intestinal distress. There's just
Montezuma's revenge.
It's Ho Chi Minh's revenge over there. Yeah. So nobody in my party got violently ill, but it was always there. Always okay. Felt a little queasy.
Well, thanks for bringing us up to date. That is the first break. Our iTunian listeners, we hope you don't think this was too much banter, but I wanted Chris to be able to share a little bit about the retirement planning system over there in Vietnam. When we come back, we're going to get into some tax court cases and IRAs, pretty much things not to do. And these are two recent cases that just came out over the past few weeks, and we'll get into them and also songs. Correct, Chris?
Perfect. So right after this break, we'll hear one of the top songs from 1935.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
I had a busy day today, full of troubles and trials, but I have put them all away and traded them for smiles. I've looked for a place in the sun, but I found a cozier one. I'm sitting high on a hilltop.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is one of the top songs from 1935 as we look back to the year that Social Security was started. That is I'm Sitting High on a Hilltop, sung here by Dick Powell from the song, from the movie Thanks a Million. I'll have to admit that's a movie I have not seen. But that's a catchy little tune from 1935.
I never heard it either.
No. Well, we played it. Actually, we've played it one other time on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Then I have heard
years
it.
Ago.
Then I have heard it.
Well, you don't pay attention every time. So.
No.
But this was a long time ago. This was a couple years ago, probably, we played that. So it was time to pull it back out again, and I doubt anybody remembers hearing it. So welcome back. We were just getting ready to talk about some tax court cases that have affected some people that tried to do things with their IRA that the IRS didn't like. And what else were we going to talk about? Oh, maybe some Ed Slott tips. But
Ed Slott stuff.
But first we're going to tackle, I like these because these are
real cases, real people.
Don't even have to change the names because this is public record.
This is public record. And the reason I wanted to talk about this first one, I got the article on this, and neither of these tax court cases did I read. The only one I ever read was the Barbro case. I think I told you that repeatedly, Chris. I downloaded that and read it several times over the weekend. I did not do that this holiday weekend. But this came to me on June 29th, so it's very recent.
Did you make your own coffee drink?
I did.
Instead of sending someone out to get Starbucks?
Yes.
Wow, things have changed since I've been gone.
Things have changed.
Wow.
But the person I normally send is not here today.
Oh, okay.
And I've come to the realization, $5 for an iced coffee at Starbucks when I can have this for probably 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Made it myself. Made the ice myself in the freezer. Mm-hmm. Made the coffee myself.
Yep.
Straws.
Yep.
Pretty damn cheap. 50 cents for 100.
Mm-hmm.
And the coffee was fairly inexpensive from Costco.
Very nice.
So you should be happy.
I support your decision. No, it's good. It's good. I'd never seen you drink out of your own plastic cup, your coffee drinks. They always have that
Starbucks
logo on the side.
Well, I'll go back to the Starbucks in the winter when I can get my hot lattes, which still we cannot make in the office.
And
But iced coffee, Justin got me convinced I was wasting my money.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, so this first one, the reason I wanted to talk about it, we've actually talked about this case, not the case, but the situation. So if this man had actually listened to the Retirement and IRA Show, he would have never been screwed over. But I also fault his attorney because it's a divorce case. I don't think his attorney knew his you-know-what from his elbow, so he got some bad advice. Mm-hmm. But the reason I thought this was appropriate, his name was Mr. Summer.
Oh, how appropriate.
And it's summer.
It's the dog days of summer, is it? No, not yet?
Oh, no, it's hotter than heck out there. Yeah, this is a hot week. It's dog days as far as I'm concerned. Actually, his name is Summers, plural. Yeah. But I
close
just
enough.
Thought it was appropriate. What happened to Mr. Summers is he was getting a divorce, which is not unheard of nowadays.
No.
And him and his wife agreed to separate his IRA. She would get half.
Mm-hmm.
And she needed the money sooner rather than later, so he separated it prior to the divorce decree, which in and of itself isn't what blew this. He blew this whole move up many times over.
Mm-hmm.
That alone would have blew it up.
Yep.
But he broke so many other rules. He then took the IRS to tax court because they said you owe taxes on this. And he filed for a claim under IRS Section 72T2-C, which I'm sure you know, Chris, is the Quadro exception. But the whole problem with 72T-2C is what?
IRAs aren't split up with a Quadro.
Exactly. So he fought in tax court with that defense. His defense was the Quadro exception. Again, I think he got lousy advice because anyone would have told him an IRA is not subject to a Quadro. So let me back this all up and explain what's going on. When you get divorced, the IRS and the government is not going to tax the legal separation of your retirement accounts amongst married folk. If you're going to separate it and give some of it to your brother because you're getting divorced from his wife. No, your brother-in-law because you're getting divorced from his whatever.
What?
I don't know. I went down a rabbit hole there. I have no idea what the hell I was going to say. But let's just say you gave the money to your brother mm-hmm. because you were getting divorced and for some reason you wanted to give your brother some of your IRA. That would be subject to taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you could separate a retirement account, be it an IRA or a 401k, is through a divorce and your spouse, not your brother, not your mother, not your grandparents, but your spouse ends up with the money. If you do it right, it's tax-free.
Correct.
It is the separation and the transferring of the money is tax-free. When the spouse takes money out of the account, they will pay the taxes, mm-hmm. not you.
Correct.
But if you do it wrong,
mm-hmm.
it's subject to taxes, even if the money goes to the spouse.
Because it's considered a distribution.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking much money here. About $35,000 was in the IRA.
And he had to go to tax court over this?
He didn't have to go to tax court.
Well, I mean, he chose to go to tax court.
He chose to tax court. Yes, he chose tax court.
Oh, my gosh.
And he had to give his wife half of $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm rounding. I don't have my calculator. The actual amount is $17,378 times 2 plus 71. So it's about
$35,000. Yeah.
So for having to give half of $35,000, a little over $17,000 to his wife, and he messed it up, he ended up going to tax court. When you separate a retirement account, there are two types of retirement account, folks. You often hear Chris and I saying, this is a qualified plan, this is a qualified plan, this is a qualified plan, this is an IRA. What we mean by qualified plan is it qualifies for special tax treatment under ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Securities Act, ERISA.
Mm-hmm.
That came out in the 70s and gave special protections to retirement accounts sponsored and offered by employers.
Correct.
And it was to protect the employee's money from the employer.
Mm-hmm.
Before ERISA came around, companies were robbing money from their pension plans and mm-hmm. spending it on operating expenses
mm-hmm.
and not keeping it in the pension. So the IRS and the Congress, well, actually it was the Congress, IRS just enforces the law. Congress created laws to protect retirement accounts. However, they also wanted to protect spouses under ERISA, if you remember. ERISA was the first time ever the government said you have to name your spouse as beneficiary of your retirement account. You cannot disinherit your spouse. They had to get it.
The spouse has to give permission.
Correct.
So it can happen, but the spouse has to participate and agree to
So under ERISA, if you get divorced, to separate the retirement account, you had to get what is known as a domestic relation order, or DRO, D-R-O. Once you create the DRO, and you do that during the divorce proceedings, you send the DRO. This kind of reminds me, this story reminds me of, you know, my that Schoolhouse Rock, just a bill on Capitol Hill. Yeah. So it starts as a bill and then becomes a law. Well, a quadro starts as a DRO. And the DRO is during the negotiation phase. Your attorney, their attorney, you're all arguing it out. And you're putting in this document who gets what. And the DRO, the domestic relation order, goes to a judge. And the judge will either yay it or nay it. If he or she yays it, he stamps it. It's approved by the courts, and it becomes qualified.
Yep.
And now the industry calls them quadro, Q-D-R-O, quadro, qualified domestic relation order. But they always begin as a DRO and then become a quadro. Okay. So that is all fine and dandy, but that can only be used to separate a qualified plan.
Right. Of which an IRA is not. A lot of people kind of put it under one on umbrella, if you will, and think that any tax-advantaged account they call a qualified account. That's not true. It has a very specific definition. IRAs are separate. They are a tax advantage, specifically a tax deferred account, but are not an ERISA qualified account.
Correct. So, goodness, all of a sudden I get the coffee and I start coughing again. Okay, so what happened in his particular case?
I need to convince Jim to start drinking coffee, cough syrup flavored lattes, maybe.
Goodness, I don't know what's going on here. I'm dying over here. Okay, so what had happened is the wife needed some money to pay off an auto loan. So they had agreed, that Mr. and Mrs. Summers, during their divorce, that they would separate the IRA 50-50 and that they would separate it with a divorce decree. So they did that part right. Mm-hmm. But she needed the money early. She needed the money early. So he separated the account. Even though the divorce decree gave her half, he separated the account. Now, it gets a little confusing in the article I read. It said she needed the money right away. So the parties agreed to this division before the divorce was finalized. That's leading me to believe, did they agree that she would get half, or did he separate it? There's not enough info here, and I didn't read the actual court case. I only get summaries of these things. But long story short, if he separated it before the courts accepted the divorce decree, then, yeah, he's screwed because he separated the accounts before the courts signed off on it. A divorce decree is totally different than a quadro. It's just going to be your attorney and her attorney, or the two spouses, if they're using attorneys, are going to argue it out, put everything in writing. The courts will accept that, and then you send a copy of the divorce decree to the custodian. Mm-hmm. The custodian with the divorce decree in hand will separate the account. Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't do that.
Mm-hmm. And he couldn't because he separated it before he had the divorce
decree. I think so. Based on that sentence I just read.
So essentially what he did is he decided to just give half of his IRA to his wife, which is
a
distribution.
Right, exactly. Well, yes, because he put it in his bank account
and
wrote
her
a check for half.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Well,
which you're allowed to do, but that's a distribution.
Correct. So the IRS sent him a letter a few years later, said, hey, you owe us taxes on that.
Yep.
Because the IRS gets a 1099 from his IRA that this money was sent out.
Yep.
They match the 1099 to his tax return and see he didn't declare this as income.
Yep.
Well, he took the IRS to tax court arguing in his defense Section 72T2C. Again, that's quadro. That says you can separate a qualified retirement account under ERISA via a quadro, and when it goes to that person, the wife in this case, it will go to her tax-free. You, meaning the husband in this case, would pay no tax on the separation, and she, meaning the wife, would pay taxes when she took the money out. But that's not what happened here. Mm-mm. He took the money out of the IRA, put it in his bank account, wrote a check to his wife from his bank account, and somehow said that was a legal separation under a rule that applies to 401ks. Well, the quadro rule is quite explicit, Chris. It says the money has to move by a direct transfer of the qualified account to the wife's account. It doesn't say that the husband can take money out of the 401k, put it in his bank account, and write his wife a check. It says it has to go direct. We call that trustee to trustee. So I know we've talked about this in the past, about other people who've done this very same thing. Well, the tax court just, you know, nailed him on all. Plus, he had the 10% early withdrawal penalty because he was under the age of 59 and a half. And again, did he get bad advice from his attorney? It never even says here if he had legal representation during this divorce. Was this a do-it-yourself divorce, you know, a divorce in a box? Are they trying to do it themselves? Was this just, hey, let's just separate this, we can handle it ourselves? Did they have attorneys? If they had attorneys, did the attorneys get it right or wrong? Even though, Chris, because there's a little ambiguity in that sentence, I don't know if he did this before or after the divorce decree. It doesn't matter.
Right,
that's what I'm saying. He did it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter if he closed this before the divorce decree was approved by the courts or after. When you separate an IRA with a divorce decree, you actually have to send a copy of it to the IRA custodian. They have to look and see, okay, this is a separation due to divorce. They will open up an IRA for the wife and separate the IRA right there. And the wife has hers, he has his, and it gets coded on the 1099 totally different. This was coded as a taxable distribution because it was. The other sad thing is I'm going to guess, what is it called when you represent yourself in court?
Pro se.
Pro se. Mm-hmm. I like Ed Slott. Every time we review these court cases where he sees pro se, he says, pro se is Latin for I am an idiot. That's what
works
he says.
Out that way a lot.
Yep. So here's a guy, I don't know if he had legal representation, I'm doubting it, only because we're talking $17,000 here. So he probably represented himself pro se, and probably somehow Googled, you know, divorce settlement, and saw, hey, under this quadro thing, I could separate a retirement account, and I'm going to argue that. Well, he didn't do that. He took a taxable distribution. When you separate a retirement account, it has to transfer by trustee to trustee transfer. So again, I just wanted to talk about this because, again, the guy's name was Summers and it is summertime. And I know we talked about this on the show in the past. Hopefully our listeners can learn a few things from this. First, get someone who knows what they're doing to give you advice. If he would have bought a half hour of our time or any other competent advisor's time who knew about retirement accounts, we could have saved this guy a lot of headaches to say, hey, yo, dude, don't do it this way. Wait for the divorce decree. Get it to the court. Your wife, she has to pay off her car loan. I get it, but, you know.
Or if the timing was you loan her the money in anticipation of this happening afterwards. So there were ways that you could get her the money early.
Or just take out a month's payment
something.
Instead of $8,000, half the account.
Yeah, that's.
So that's, again, it's a sad case because obviously this gentleman didn't have a lot of money. So the $17,000 for him was very, very important. I'm just going to assume the tax court summary does list that he had no other retirement accounts. So, I mean, it's a sad case because he got screwed, not the wife. He had to pay the taxes on the $17,500 plus a 10% penalty on top of that. She got the money and got to pay off the auto loan, and he's left holding the bag, and tax court just said no. So anyways, that was that case. I thought that was interesting, but I know we've talked about that. You remember talking about these in the past, I'm sure.
Yeah, and make sure if you are in the process of getting a divorce, make sure that whoever's helping you with this, if you're dealing with a 401k and you have IRAs and all that sort of thing, that the person you're... Because I have heard attorneys even that believe that IRAs are split with quadros.
You've met attorneys who...
Yes.
Divorce attorneys?
Yes. That they swore up and down that a quadro splits all of these accounts, including IRAs.
No.
So I... And we've discovered that long ago. And so just make sure that they're talking about the distinction between them. Because otherwise, if you break the process, you can end up with owing taxes and penalties that you could otherwise avoid. So just make sure that you're dealing with competent help on these sorts of things. Just heads
up. I just always say quadros will break an ERISA retirement account. Mm-hmm. Divorce decrees separate a non-ERISA retirement account, which right. just happens to be IRAs.
Right.
So that's how I just generally do it. Listeners, if your divorce attorney is telling you your IRA will be separated with the quadro, find a new divorce attorney. Because if they don't know that...
The reason you're hiring them is they know the specifics and the details that a regular person doesn't know. So if they don't have this, if they don't have it quite the expertise to know the difference, that would call into question their level of...
Expertise on everything else.
On everything else.
Because this is the easy part.
One would think. Because it's just following the rules.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I often say retirement planning is an art based on science. It's an art because some of the advice we give people, other advisors may argue, I would have done it this way instead of that way. But it's based on science. There's certain rules we must follow. One of those rules, quadros, break up 401ks, divorce decrees, break up IRAs. There's no change. There's no ambiguity. There's no, unless it's a leap year and in an odd on an odd month, there's no rule like that. This is the rule. So it's an art based on science. If your divorce attorney doesn't know the science part, you might want to find a new one. Okay, this next case, how much time do we have?
We have about 2.5 minutes.
Ooh.
So you can maybe give a teaser.
I'll give a tease. This one, I liked. The guy won, and I can't say this for certain, but I think he stretched... I'm not saying anything.
But people can come to their own conclusions.
You can come to your own conclusions if you feel... Would he'd be the plaintiff or the defendant here?
No, he'd be the defendant because the IRS is trying to go after him for taxes.
Yeah, IRS took him to court.
Yeah.
No, I think he took the IRS to court.
Well, they sent him a bill. So
right, and
the
he said no, I go to court.
He said no, and he wants to go to
so
court.
So he's the defendant?
I think he technically is. That's a good question, though. When you go to the tax court, since you're the one who called for it, you're defending yourself against the IRS who's pursuing you for taxes.
And so. In fact, I think they call it some... I don't think they call it
they probably don't.
Defendant
or plaintiff.
No, they call
no,
it something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is another word for it now that I think
like
of it.
Petitioner.
Petitioner. And, yeah. Something like that. But anyways, my point is, I think he... pushed the envelope on some areas where the tax court believed him. So I'm going to encourage our listeners to do you really think it happened this way or not? And the point is, though, he took money, Chris, $50,000. So now we're starting to get up to some serious cash. He took $50,000 out of his IRA. And I guess you could say, when is a distribution not a distribution? When the man here does what he did.
Well, he was trying to make an investment that he wanted to hold within his IRA so that it continued to have the tax deferral treatment of an
Correct.
IRA. But he did. He acquired a non-traditional asset, we call them.
Yes. So we'll get into this, but the court ruled it was not a prohibited transaction, which was very important because that would have blew up the entire IRA. And also ruled totally in favor of the petitioner. Is that what we think it is?
Sure.
And not the IRS on a $50,000 distribution. So we'll get back to this when we return after this short break.
Great. So this week's top hit back in 1977, we're going to look back 40 years. We're going to hear that when we come back, and it's the only hit for the singer-songwriter Alan O'Day.
Oh, wow, that's a great
hit. Do you remember Alan O'Day? He was a one-hit wonder.
Alan O'Day?
Mm-hmm, in 1977.
Negative. Is it a disco song?
Kind of.
Oh.
Solid.
Your hints are horrendous. Go back to Vietnam.
We'll hear what song that is after this short break.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Softly said, wonder is your nightlight, magic is your dream. And as I held her, she said, see what I mean. I said, what? She said, woo-hoo-wee. I said,
welcome
right.
Back to the Retirement and IRA Show.
She said, love me, love me, love me.
So that is the number one song this year, or this week, back in 1977. It's a one-hit wonder for Alan O'Day. It was Undercover Angel. Do you recognize it now?
I do.
Yeah. Do you listen to it a lot back in 1977?
I definitely recognize this song, but yeah. I would have never guessed this was Alan O'Day or whatever his name is.
Nor that it hit number one. I was a little surprised at that. Song is often referred to as a nocturnal novelette, whatever the heck that means.
No idea.
O'Day is better known for the songs he's written
for other people.
For the likes of Bobby Sherman, Cher, The Righteous Brothers, and Helen Reddy. So he was a writer, sang a little bit, hit it big once. That was it. So I was going to say, why do we listen to this? These songs all have some kind of a tie to Social Security.
That they do.
Listen to the first one, last break in 1935. That was the year that Social Security started. This one's 40 years ago this week, so we are tying into what's referred to in the Social Security rules as 40 elapsed years, which is what they thought of as to be the typical career length. So in honor of the 40 elapsed years terminology in the Social Security rules, we look back 40 years to the number one hit each week, and this week it was Undercover Angel.
Excellent, and then we'll have one from 35 years ago in the next segment.
Right, which then connects to the 35 computational years.
Correct, and this all ties into our blog, What's New on HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com. That is our Social Security blog. We hope to have sometime this year, later on this year, I should let Justin know these things. He'll probably be joining you in the last segment because I'm probably going to be running late, so I won't be here for the last segment. But I want Justin to be doing his tax blog soon. He's supposed to be blogging on Help With My Retirement Taxes, our other website that's not up and running yet. So I haven't told him
Is
that.
Is there a limit
news.
On the number of websites we can have?
Negative.
That's too bad.
So... So hopefully he'll be up and running on that. But we all do this because it ties into the current blog that we do have, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. The other thing I want to mention before people forget, Chris and I do this for a living, or at least I do. Chris actually teaches financial planning for a living at Colorado State University when he's not out in NAM hanging around there teaching them economics or finance, whatever it was you would teach. Was it economics or finance you taught him?
Finance.
Finance. Mm-hmm. But if anybody is listening, if there is anybody out there listening to our show, we are available for consultation. We don't say that enough on this show. And you need not live in Colorado. We actually work with people throughout the United States with our unique business model. And our business model is you hire us and pay us for just the services you need. We don't have an asset minimum. You don't have to roll over your money. Most of our iTunian listeners are do-it-yourselfers anyways. They're quite astute and comfortable, Chris, managing their own money. I would say the majority of people who contact us off of iTunes have all their money at Vanguard, so that speaks a lot to the Vanguard model. But what they're looking for is advice beyond an 800 number to Vanguard on their investment portfolio. They may want to know, can I retire? Do I have enough money? Do I need to worry about required minimum distributions? What are the tax implications of retirement going to look like for me? How do I optimize my Social Security? Should I take a pension or a lump sum payout from my employer? What are 401k distribution rules? What are IRA distribution rules? They have all these questions that they can't necessarily get from an 800 number, especially someone who can only give advice on, say, a Vanguard investment. And instead, they just need to hire someone who's not going to try to jam a product down their throat. Well, that's exactly what our firm does. So we do counsel and work for people. We charge flat fees for our advice. And you can simply contact us, go right to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S, .com. Learn a little bit about us. That whole website's going to be redone, by the way, folks. Sometime before the end of the year, we're going to have a lot of it changed. There'll be new videos on the website as well. I haven't told you that part, Chris. I told you about a cartoon introductory video we're coming out with, but we're also going to record tax video, Social Security video, investment video, and you're more than welcome to record the Social Security video if you'd like. You don't have to.
Do I get a cartoon character in my likeness created for me?
No, these will be real live videos of us. Although I could see if Baby Huey is available.
I still don't see the tie-in to Baby Huey, but...
Oh, not Huey. Junior, isn't that his name? The bear? Junior?
Junior is the bear. Baby Huey's a duck. A giant duck.
Well, you could
a very
be Baby
large
Huey.
Duck.
And Junior is that very large bear.
He is a large bear. Yeah. So, why in cartoons is the baby always the largest of the family?
I don't know. But we could see if we could get Junior or Baby Huey to play Chris in a Social Security video.
Maybe we could just come up with a new character.
Create our own?
Yeah.
So we will have some characters on a video that we'll be coming out with on our website, talking a little bit about what we do and what makes Jim Solon and Associates different. But we do want to extend that opportunity to all our iTunian do-it-yourselfers. If you'd like some advice on your retirement, can you retire? Do I have the ability to retire? If you want those questions answered, but you don't want something jammed down your throat and you just want to pay for some advice, give us a call or come to our website. We could probably assist you there. Okay, so let's get to this because I may have you and our junior, otherwise known as Justin, carry this into the second or the final segment as well, because I probably won't be here. This case really intrigued me. I read this several times when I saw it come out. It just came out. This one is hot off the presses. And it all began in 2011. And wow, the tax court is just settling it now.
Goodness.
So that's how long these things
the
can
wheels
get
of justice turn slowly.
You think? And this is a gentleman named Mr. McGaugh. G-A-U-G-H. M-C-G-A-U-G-H. Does that sound like McGaugh?
Could be McGaugh.
McGaugh?
Could be.
Some Irish dude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's between him and the IRS. We'll call him, should we say McGough, McGo, or some Irish dude?
I'll look it up.
How are you going to look up
I can look up how it's pronounced.
All right. Well, while Chris is figuring out how this man's name is pronounced.
Does he have a first name? We could just call him Bill.
No, they just call
him. Or George. Him George. George McGough.
We could call him George. We could protect his privacy. And wait a minute. Raymond.
Raymond. There it is. From here on out, for the rest of the show, it is Raymond.
So you want to just call him Raymond?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So his first name is Raymond. His last name is either McGough, McGough, or some Irish dude. But what he did is he wanted to buy Chris private stock in his IRA. Now, is there anything against the law on that?
No. You can own lots of things in your. There's only a very small list of things expressly prohibited from being owned in your IRA, such as life insurance.
And collectibles. That's pretty much it.
That's pretty much it. So, I mean, there's a very short list of things that they just say you cannot do this. Everything else is okay as long as it follows all the, doesn't violate any of the other rules regarding IRAs. But as far as them saying you can or cannot own, you know, XYZ in your IRA, short list of banned items. Stock shares in a private corporation, which is what we're talking about here, totally fine.
Okay. I'm not going to name the brokerage house that is involved in this. I suppose I could, but FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, that I have to abide by their rules still, they get a little antsy if we mention brokers because the brokerage house really didn't do anything wrong. They weren't right. They weren't wrong in this case. I think Raymond is the one that pushed the envelope in a few areas and how this whole case got into tax court. So we'll just call them the brokerage house, okay?
McGough.
McGough?
Mm-hmm. But Raymond is fine.
Isn't he the crime dog? Oh, that's McGruff.
McGruff.
Remember McGruff the crime dog?
Yes, I know McGruff the crime dog. From, was he... I know. I can picture him. He's got the trench coat.
Yeah, he was on those commercials. Yeah. McGruff, the crime dog.
Yes. That's not this guy. This is Raymond McGough.
McGough.
Yes, McGough.
So it's not McGough.
Nope, it's McGough.
McGough.
According to my official sources on the internet.
Okay. And if it's on the internet, it's got to be real. Okay, so we'll just call him Ray and Brokerage House.
Okay.
Okay. So Ray, in October 7th, if you want to know the exact date, 2011, wanted to buy $50,000 of stock in a privately held company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, folks, when you're buying stock in a private company, it's not like a public company, Chris, where you would go to just a brokerage house and say, yeah, buy me $50,000 of Microsoft. And it's a publicly traded company on an exchange. They can. It's all computerized nowadays. They can type into their dollar amount, $50,000, set a limit order if they want, and boom, done. Very quick and easy.
Mm-hmm.
Private stock is different. You actually have to send the money to the company. It's not on an exchange. The company's got to get the $50,000, and the company will issue shares of the stock.
Mm-hmm.
One big share that says this is 50,000 shares. Or dollars, or maybe that 50,000 bought 10,000 shares, and there's what you get. But the money has to go to the company, and the company will handle all this. Or and on a large private company, they may have, you wouldn't send it to the company, they may have an intermediary there.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, that's how it's done. But there is nothing against the law on owning stock in a private company. Now, do not buy stock in a private company that your wife owns, or your grandparents own, or your parents own, or your kids own. But you could, you know where I'm going with this, you could buy private stock in
your brother's firm.
Your brother and sister's firm.
Yeah. Well, we don't recommend
it. We don't recommend it, but they're the one family members that, in the IRS's definition of a prohibited individual, siblings are not named. But don't, as Ed says, don't try that at home.
Right, don't try it.
So that's not what happened here. This, he had no relationship to this business. I only share that because I don't want someone listening to this thinking, oh, goodness, my sister's starting a private company. I'm going to use my IRA money to invest in it. No, you cannot invest in a company with a prohibited person or disqualified person. And disqualified person is pretty much anyone.
Family members.
Yeah, except brothers and sisters for some odd reason. Okay. It was a totally independent company. So he called up his brokerage house and said, I would like to own $50,000 of this private company. And he gave him the name of the private company. And the brokerage house said, no, we don't do that. Now, they don't have to allow private stock in there. They could or they don't. Mm-hmm. Not all custodians are going to do things.
Just like if you called them and asked them to invest in real estate. Not all custodians do so, even though you can technically own real estate in an IRA. No, again, not something we highly recommend.
Now, in my court summary, the reasons why I said brokerage house would not buy the private stock were not provided. But my gut tells me they don't make anything off of it. They make money. If they were the intermediary of the private company, or if they were buying stock on a public exchange and they were making a commission, maybe they would allow it. I don't know.
Well, they probably just don't have the processes in place.
And the processes in place to handle
it. So it'd be really expensive for this one-off kind of a situation. Yeah. So they just say, no, we don't do that.
And for the size brokerage house we're talking here, $50,000 is a drop in the bucket to these guys.
So they're not going to mess with it.
They're not going to mess with it. So they said no.
Yep.
So Ray did the next best thing. Hmm. Do you have any idea what Ray did?
Violated the rules.
According to tax court, no, he did not. Right. Wow. According to said brokerage house, he did.
Yeah.
What he then said is, all right, well, if you don't want to buy it, wire $50,000 to this company. And he gave them wiring instructions. $50,000 from his IRA to this company, and he sent them wiring instructions. Mm-hmm. Brokerage house obliged, and on October 7th, 2011, sent out $50,000 to that company's, the wiring instructions that that company wanted. Mm-hmm. That company, on November 28th, 2011, so almost 20 days later, no, more than that, goodness, almost 2 months later, 2.5 months later, almost 2.5 months later, that private company issued a single stock certificate titled Raymond McGuff. Is that it?
McGuff.
Raymond McGuff, IRA, FBO, Raymond McGuff. That was actually very good
did. They got the titling correct.
They did. FBO, for those who don't know, that's Frank Bruno Oscar. FBO stands for For Benefit Of. That's all it is.
Yeah, so they issued it to the IRA. So the IRA owns it.
Absolutely.
Which is avoiding one of the problems, which is you can't own it in another titling.
It's the tax court specifically referenced that.
And said, good to go.
That was very good, according to tax court.
I agree.
Because it wasn't issued in his name. Okay, so the private company took said stock certificate on November 28th, 2011, and sent it to the brokerage house. Mm-hmm. Did not send it to Ray, sent it to the brokerage house. So the brokerage house gets this in the mail, opens up the mail, and sees this stock certificate. And the brokerage house refused it. Didn't want it. So the brokerage house put it in another envelope, and guess what they did with it?
Mailed it to Ray.
Mailed it to Ray. Exactly. So they mailed it to Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what Ray did?
Got it in the mail?
He got it in the mail, but he did not open it. He did not accept it. It was returned to sender. Hmm. So I don't think Ray even, I think if, how does something go back to sender? Return to sender? Destination unknown?
Don't open it and the mailman takes it back and sends it back to who sent it.
So it probably required a signature and he didn't answer the door or something?
Correct. sometimes, believe it or not, you can get away with it. It shows up as long as you don't open it. You can write return to sender on it and take it back to the post office and hand it to them, and it'll go back as long as it hasn't been opened.
See, this summer...
So I don't know what he did.
That's key in this case. I'd like to know how it was returned to sender. I'm probably going to have to download this court case and read it because the summaries, I only get the summaries. Mm-hmm. The summary didn't get into that. But that happened not once, Chris, but twice. Mm. So two times, it's kind of like a hot potato here. Nobody wants it. The company, the private company, sends it to the brokerage house. Brokerage house says, we don't want this. We don't allow private stock in our IRAs. Mm-hmm. So they send it to their client, Raymond. Somehow it gets returned to the brokerage house twice, returned to sender. The third time, the brokerage house sends it FedEx. And we don't know in the summary, did Ray sign for it? But my gut says no, because Ray claims he never got it. But the brokerage house says we never got it back. And they never said, and I don't think they called FedEx in to testify, there was no information on what FedEx claims. Hey, here's a signature. Someone accepted it, or we left it on the door, or we lost it. So it doesn't get into that. So I can only tell you those three instances. The brokerage house mailed it to him twice, and twice it was sent back, returned to sender. The third time they used FedEx, it never got returned to the brokerage house, but Ray testified in court, I don't have the certificate, never saw it, never got it. So I find that to be interesting. Who returned the item? And do you have to actually accept the envelope before you can return to sender? Because what played a crucial role in this court decision was a concept known as constructive receipt. Do you at some point in time, even though you don't have the stock certificate in this case or money in another case, you don't physically have it, it is in a location that you can easily access. It would be like somebody wiring money into your bank account, Chris, and you saying, I never touched that money and I never got it. Well, it's in your bank account. You can get it anytime you want. That's constructive receipt. That played a huge role in this case, because what happened is the IRS gets wind of all this because said brokerage account issued in 2011 a 1099-R for a $50,000 distribution.
For the money they wired to the company.
For the money they wired to the company. Ray testified in court he never got the 1099, so he didn't know that that had happened. Possible?
He has trouble with his mail.
He does have trouble with his mail. Mail doesn't get to Ray.
Very easily. Bounces back, just disappears.
Disappears, bounces back. That's why I'm saying, is Ray pushing the envelope here? I don't know. I can't say. But Ray testified in court, never got a 1099, so he didn't know this was recorded as a taxable distribution. Hmm. He never got a 1099. And apparently his broker never mentioned anything to him. I don't know. So the IRS, we've talked about this, as in the last case we just talked about. IRS gets all these 1099s, folks, and they're going to match up. If they have a 1099-R showing a 50K distribution in 2011, 2012, 2013 is when they get around to this. They're going to be pulling your tax return to make sure you declared 50K of income. And guess what? Ray did not.
Right.
Now, he testified in tax court. He didn't for two simple reasons. Number one, he never got the 1099. And number two, he claimed that the purchase of the stock was not a distribution, but a legal transfer. Mm-hmm. The IRS said, no. This was a distribution. Because the money went to a third party, just because it didn't go to Ray, it went directly to a third party. That's a distribution. If you send money to a third party, the IRS claimed that's a distribution. That was their first thing. And the second thing is they said he had constructive receipt of the stock certificate, Ray claims I never received the stock certificate. This ends up in tax court. Ray won on all levels. And here's where it got real interesting. Excuse me. So the first thing, remember what the IRS said? Oh, we got 2 minutes left? Okay. Well, I might be able to record maybe 5 or 10 minutes in the next segment, and then you and Junior will handle it. Okay. But the IRS took him to court on two things. The first thing he said was, it was a distribution. You sent the money to a third party. That is a distribution. Second thing the IRS said, you had constructive receipt of the certificate. Therefore, it is a distribution. Ray won on both of those. When we come back, I'll explain what the tax court said. And it's very, very important that he never had control of that stock certificate. So if truly FedEx lost that stock certificate, that was a lucky thing for Ray. And we'll get into what the tax court said after this segment. Commercial, whatever it is. Commercial, right?
Well, it's a break.
It's a break. I guess. Well, it's a commercial on KFKA.
Kind of a commercial.
It's a break for our iTunes.
It's an announcement. It's a status update.
But when we come back, we're going to have the number one song in America from 35 years ago.
We are, and we might even have an update on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. I'll have to check and see what was running this week to see what in fact is new this week. Because I'm not sure where that all left off. I know there is one. We'll see what it is. So when we come back, we're going to hear the number one song from 35 years ago this week, which would be back in 1982. Actually, we're not going to hear the number one song. I take it back. Ebony and Ivory is still the number one song back in 1982. So we're going to play another top 10 hit. This week's song made it to the number 8 spot on the pop charts, but it hit number 1 on the country charts and went on to win 3 Grammys and Country Music Association Song of the Year.
Wow.
So this is a crossover hit, which high on both... you know, I'm reading off the wrong page here. This whole show is just getting all kind of confused.
So apparently we don't know what we're coming back with.
We're going to come back with a song from 35 years ago this week, back in 1982. And we're all going to discover what that song is after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. As I mentioned right before the break, I was reading the wrong intro. This is not a country crossover hit. This is clearly the Human League and Don't You Want Me, which was the number one song from 1982 this week. So very popular song. A lot of people know it even today. Enough said about that song.
And there is no update on Help With My Social Security.
And on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, I forgot, yesterday was the 4th of July. So this week was an off week for the blog and simply a Happy Birthday America message. And we'll be back next week with a brand new post. So no update on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
Okay. Well,
which is good because we need to finish.
We have to finish because I got to get going. But we have Justin Fundalinski joining us.
Howdy.
Good afternoon, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
We're doing well. For those who don't know, Justin has been working with us for about 3 years now in the office, And his specialty is taxes, tax preparation, and advanced tax planning for retirees. We decided to bring him on because yours truly is going to talk a little bit more about this
McGuff.
We got to talk a little bit more about this tax court case, and then I got to run because I'm running late for a meeting. So Justin is going to actually answer an email question later, aren't you, Justin?
I am.
And just real quickly, do we have said state from that email question?
It's George from Illinois.
Do we have Illinois?
Oh, we definitely have Illinois.
We definitely have Illinois.
All right. Well, I can have Chris and Justin explain the states in a minute. Let's jump back into Ray McGuff and some of the issues he ran into. So the whole gist of this case, not gist, that was
gist.
Wrong. Gist. The whole, thank you, Chris. Mm-hmm. The whole gist of Ray's defense was he claimed there was no taxable distribution, and the IRS claimed there was. The Seventh Circuit ruled in his favor on two counts. The first thing they said, the IRS claimed because the money came out of his IRA and went to a third party, that was a distribution. It didn't go to another IRA.
That's a silly argument, I think. That in and of itself, that's silly. I can't believe they made that argument.
Well, the tax court actually sided with them and said, we understand it. If money goes to a third party, it could be a taxable distribution.
It could be.
Could be.
That doesn't guarantee it
is. But it doesn't mean it is.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what happened to the money, the tax court said, when it went to the third party. Mm-hmm. And they said it was used to purchase a perfectly legitimate and legal investment.
Yep.
For an IRA.
It's not like he sent it there to buy products.
No.
He bought stock shares.
What they said essentially was the movement from the IRA to the third party doesn't make it a taxable distribution. What happens to the money when it gets there?
Yes.
Is the taxable distribution or not? And they said to transfer money to a privately held company to buy stock in that company, to follow the rules that that company said you must follow to buy shares, to invest in us, is not a taxable distribution.
No, I agree.
So they won on that one. But they also went on to say, was there constructive receipt? They said two things saved Ray. First, the company sent some sort of documentation that they sent the shares to the brokerage house titled, as I said earlier.
Right. So they didn't send it to him personally.
No.
Titled him.
Sent,
they sent it titled to his IRA.
Correct. And it was made out specifically, Ray McGuff, FBO, no, IRA.
IRA.
Ray McGuff, FBO, Ray McGuff. Mm-hmm. So they said, first thing is Ray has testified he doesn't have the stock certificates and never did. Mm-hmm. And the IRS said he had constructive receipt. And the tax court said no, because Ray testified he never got the shares, and he still says he doesn't know where the shares are.
I would argue even if he physically received it the way it was titled, he could still argue he didn't have constructive
receipt. And the tax
receipt.
Court said that because of the way the company made the shares out. If the shares were made out to Ray McGuff, now it becomes a constructive receipt question here. Mm-hmm. I never got them. And that isn't the case here. Ray is testifying, rightly or wrongly, he never got them. Returned to sender twice. FedEx delivers it. He says, I don't know what the hell FedEx did with it. I don't have them. And there's no reference. That's why I may download this court case and read it. There's no information in the summary I got. What did FedEx say? And, you know, in this day and age, they can find an envelope. Did they leave it there? Did they deliver it to someone? Did it get stolen off the porch? But the tax court basically said on those two areas, it wasn't made payable to him. It was made payable to the IRA. And it wasn't constructive receipt, because the theory of constructive receipt is even though you don't have the asset, you can access that asset very easily and unencumbered.
Unencumbered.
Unencumbered. I got it. Unencumbered. Lee.
Uninhibited.
Lee.
Yeah, combine. Yeah. See, I was going the other way.
Uninhibited? Mm-hmm. He tried to combine the two. Mm-hmm. That's how he does it.
Yeah. Well, that works.
What did I combine?
Uninhibited and unencumbered.
What did I say?
Some mutation of those two together.
Cubited. I don't know what it was.
Well, you guys understood what I was
going.
We got it.
Yeah.
We had to translate for everyone else.
Yes.
But as the IRS said, as the tax court said, the tax court was saying, look, IRS, we agree if he had constructive receipt, but he didn't. Nobody knows where the stock certificates are. And in fact, no new stock certificates have been issued because the company refuses to issue them without a notice from the brokerage house that they don't have them. And the brokerage house is saying, well, obviously, we don't know where the stock certificates are. So no new stock certificates have been issued. These other stock certificates are missing. But even if they were found, the tax court said the way they were made out, according to the company, means they were made out to the IRA. The whole issue here is he has a custodian that won't hold a perfectly legal asset. Mm-hmm. And it's not the custodian's fault. That's why I don't want to name them and throw them under the bus. They just don't want to own a private stock certificate.
They don't want to keep it in the filing cabinet for them.
So, unique case. Mm-hmm. I think the IRS was really reaching here on this particular case.
I think so, too. I'm surprised they took him to task on this one.
But he won on all levels.
Good.
But the problem is, 6 years this case took. There's still no stock certificates. So, is this guy out the money? And look at all he's probably paid in legal fees. If he'd have just done things right, when his custodian said,
no,
we're not going to allow
find
this,
a custodian
find
we'll
a custodian
it.
That will.
Yep.
Just don't transfer money directly to a company and say, mail those to my custodian.
And hope it all works out.
Exactly.
They said no, but I don't believe them. I'm going to make them take these things.
And Ray, get better mail service, because apparently packages can't be delivered to you. Something tells me these stock certificates are going to be found.
Could be. Miraculously.
Now that the court has ruled there's no constructive receipt, even if, because of the way they were made out, I think FedEx is going to find these.
Oh, yeah. FedEx will find them, right? Under his bed?
No. Oh. We're not saying that about Ray.
Okay.
No. But Ray testified in court under oath, Justin.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear that part.
No. Nope. Yeah.
I should assume that.
Nope. So never assume. But anyways, I'm glad it all worked out for Ray. And hopefully someone will find these stock certificates and he can get them into an IRA. The moral of the story, folks, if your custodian says we don't allow this, they don't allow it. Find a custodian who does. Okay, I'm out of here. Chris and Justin are going to take over with an email question, and I will chat with everybody next week. Chris, welcome back. Great to have you in the office again. We haven't had a chance to talk. You literally walked in, and we went straight into the recording studio. But you're looking good from your stay in Vietnam, and we will catch up. Okay.
Perfect. Have a nice time wherever you're going.
Thank you.
So, Justin,
yeah.
What exciting new tax-related topic do you have for us in the last 14 minutes?
Well, 14 minutes is going to cut us really, really tight here. We've got a little bit of a long email to read, and it's a bit of a complex topic, but I will do my best. So this is from George from Illinois. Mm-hmm. Says, Jim, thanks for a great show. Very informative and entertaining. Jim should have heard that. He'd be patting himself on the back right there. I wanted to get your thoughts on how to think about Roth versus deductible contributions to 401k when we are subject to the alternative minimum tax every year. We max out 401k contributions, my spouse's plus mine, including the 6K catch-up, and now that I'm 50. We max out non-deductible IRA that we then do a backdoor Roth. So he's really trying to max out his contributions, it sounds like. I have begun converting shortly after contributing, but you guys are getting me concerned that they may disallow that some of my past contributions, so now he's waiting 45 to 60 days. Okay, that's good. I'm going to get to the meat of it here. For my wife's 401k, I have been contributing as Roth to help diversify our savings across the never-taxed, tax-deferred, and regular accounts, which is something we typically advise here. We like tax diversification. We are in the 33 marginal tax bracket, but given we are hit with alternative minimum tax, I view my marginal tax as 28%. given you are hit with AMT if you're not paying 28% after the base amount of income. We'll get on that a little bit. At 28%, I can justify Roth contributions to help diversify my assets. At 33%, I probably would lean toward going back to deductible contributions. I am thinking about my marginal, or am I thinking about my marginal tax rate correctly when thinking about tax savings today for deducting contributions versus Roth contributions? Oof.
There's a lot in there.
It's wordy, yeah. So really what he's saying is, you know, he's subject to AMT. There's two different essentially ways to calculate your taxes. Most people are affected by the standard way. You actually do calculate it the AMT way, but most people don't have to do that. We're very used to the marginal tax rates, 0, 10, 15, et cetera. And, you know, essentially what it is when he calculates it on the AMT schedule, he has to pay more. So he's a high earner, likely. He may have some deductions that he has to add back, things like that, which make him subject to this AMT. I'm going to go out and flat out say you are taking that 28% rate at a very baseline level. If you thought about it only in that sense, you're really not thinking about AMT appropriately. The way that works is I think we need to do a quick education on what is effective versus marginal versus effective marginal. So we all know effective rate is essentially your average tax rate. If you're taxed at 10% at a certain amount, 15% at a certain amount, 25% at a certain amount, you average it all out, it's probably around 17, 18%. That's your effective rate. We've all heard that before, right?
Right.
The marginal rate is something that we've all heard before also. So what is my next dollar going to be taxed at in this bracket that I'm in? So I'm in the 25% bracket. Every dollar I earn at that point in time theoretically is taxed at 25%. But the reality is there's this effective marginal factor that comes in. So that's really what the real amount that you're being taxed at for every dollar that's in that bracket. And a way to think about that is as you earn more money, you actually lose deductions or more income has to come into the tax side of things.
Credits are phased out.
Exactly.
There's all kinds of things that happen as your income goes up beyond just moving through tax brackets.
Exactly. So that's your effective marginal rate. Mm-hmm. And generally that is substantially higher than your actual marginal rate. A lot of times for common folk, average earners, the marginal rate is close enough to the effective marginal rate, so we can use that as our baseline. But this effective marginal rate, it plays a big role in AMT. Alternative minimum tax essentially gives you a amount that is excluded from it, right? So if you're married, filing jointly, I think it's around $85,000 of the AMT income is excluded. And from there, everything above that is taxed at either 26 or 28%. Now, he's saying he's at 28%, so he blows through the 26 rate and gets even into the 28% rate. But the problem is at some point in time, when you're in that 26% rate, that exclusion that you have becomes phased out. Okay, so what it means is every dollar you're earning, you're taking away some of that exclusion, and it's being taxed at either 26 or 28. So what you have to think about then is it's every dollar you earn is essentially 1.25% higher than 28 or 26%. So your effective marginal rate is really at 26%, it's 32.5%.
Right.
Or at 28%, 35%. So it's highly likely your actual effective marginal rate is in those areas, especially if you're earning that much. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, it's probably a good idea to, I'd say, keep contributing to a regular
deductible,
401k, a deductible
right,
one.
The deductible one where you're avoiding taxes today. You'll pay taxes in the future, but, you know, he's at a high enough tax bracket. Effectively, the choice of making the decision between deducting or not deducting contributions to the retirement account, the non-deductible choice means that he's avoiding the tax today, which is quite high, in hopes that it won't get worse, right? The bottom line story is eventually down the road, and this is obviously ignoring some of the RMD issues that create other problems, but if you're talking about just the taxes themselves, as long as the taxes don't go up, the decision is an either or, you end up in the same place,
right,
kind of a situation. hopefully he'll be in a situation where his taxes, effective taxes, are lower in retirement, then he made the right choice to defer taxes. The only downside is he's in that, I guess, targeted category of high earners, which if he accumulates enough assets, he might very well find himself in high tax area, same rate or higher. But
I will say of all the retirement plans that we do, and we've done some high earners with millions in their accounts, generally it's pretty rare that I see people breaching the 28% bracket with RMDs.
Yeah.
Really rare. So I guess it's going to depend on how much you have in IRAs at this point. Mm-hmm. But I'm working with people that are maxing out 401ks quite a bit. And to see it breach 28 is pretty rare. So I think maybe some projections would be a good idea to find out what rate you're actually going to be paying at. But gut feeling, probably a deductible 401k contribution.
And he's over 50 because he's making the catch-up. Does he say how old he is?
Let's see. He says now that I'm over 50. Yeah,
he's over 50.
Yeah.
The more important part would be, you know, when he's going to retire, when he's going to start distributing the money out of some of these accounts. He might have a fairly substantial golden tax window.
Golden tax, right? Yeah, a tax void.
The tax void, or whatever you want to call it, where you have this sweet spot between 70 and a half when RMDs kick in, and when you retire and you have your ordinary income stop and you're mostly relying upon distributions from somewhere in order to live, you have a lot of flexibility in that the time when that window is open. And he's a high enough earner where it might be possible for him to retire young,
or he
might not be intending to. And that's going to be a big question here. Is he going to have a big, wide open golden window where he has got a lot of tax flexibility, or is he not planning on opening that window? If he plans to work and earn until 70, he will never have a window.
Right.
And he will be completely at the mercy of RMDs coming out of these accounts. 100% with no flexibility. So his question, as in a lot of things with retirement planning, creates other questions.
Absolutely.
And the only way to, there's no simple answer to any of these types of things. It always depends on everything else that's going on. It's, you can have some general rules, and people, I think where people in the retirement advice arena get into trouble is they'll make recommendations or, you know, maybe they have a show like we do here, and they'll make a recommendation that probably applies to most people, right? Mm-hmm. That it generally works this way. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say this is what you should do. But there's a lot of people, even if it's the minority, it's a number much higher than one of people that will have something else in their story, something else in their financial lives that will matter to this question, that will create a secondary issue, maybe substantial, that would cause you to have completely different advice. So I would encourage this person needs some planning.
I completely agree on that.
He needs a more holistic approach. He needs to answer a lot more questions about his situation and his life goals and where he sees his career going and when he plans to retire and all that sort of thing. I know he created a lot of detail in his question, hoping that was enough to answer the question.
Well, he's done his research. He's clearly listened to the show.
Correct. Correct. And it's good. It's a great question, and I applaud him wholeheartedly for asking the question, because this is definitely something he should be pondering.
Absolutely.
This could be very important in the overall success. You know, nobody wants to pay more taxes than they have to. Everybody should pay their taxes as they're due, but there's no reason to pay more than you need to.
Mm-hmm.
And his decisions in this realm might generate, you know, if they're bad decisions, higher tax burden than he really needs.
Yeah.
But the right approach is going to depend on other things he hasn't included in this question.
Yeah, he needs to answer questions like, what is his real effective marginal tax rate, and when is he going to retire, and how much will he be able to get out of those accounts at lower rates, and for how long can you do that? There's just a variety of things out there. So I agree that a full plan, an income plan, just projecting his income sources and really taking that and overlaying the income over the tax brackets and the tax code and getting a full picture will actually give him a much better answer than me saying no.
Perfect. So, have you reached back to this person yet, or this fresh?
No. This landed on my desk. I don't know when you guys started
earlier
recording.
Today?
Yeah. Just
Jim said, "Hey, take a look at this."
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yes.
Well, at least he gave you a warning. He could have invited you in and laid that
in front of
you.
That would have been a tough one just to take off. But no, it's a great question. I had to digest what he was asking there, and I thought, I don't think he quite understands the AMT, and I think that understanding that
it's just a confusing piece, as confusing as taxes are in general. Whenever some of these little side extra things that have been bolted on are terrible to try to maneuver and understand.
There's some really interesting stuff on the effective marginal rate, especially people at lower income when they start phasing out the earned income credits and things like that. Those tax rates get into the high 80s, 90%. And of course, they would never see that number that you're being taxed at that rate. But if you lose a earned income credit, or you lose certain child
lose
tax
the ability
credit, whatever,
to write
maybe
off student loan interest,
but those
child
kind of
tax credits, all those things,
those
absolutely
big, I guess they call them welfare benefits to some degree, that get cut quite quickly. Those are really bad times. So, it's like, they've made cases where, why don't people work harder and earn more money? It's because they're not going to earn any more money. It's because it's all going to go to tax.
Right.
So really interesting stuff there.
Yeah. So thanks for dropping in. I'll actually be interested to follow this as hopefully he engages and gets back to us, and maybe you guys go back and forth on this a little bit.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear more of his story and how how the plan might come together to manage his taxes. So,
agreed. And I had to answer that all in pretty much one breath due to the time constraints. So if you have any more questions on it, give me an email or give us a call here at the office.
Yeah, so contact us at jimhelps.com, whether it's tax advice or Social Security advice or just overall retirement planning advice. Jimhelps.com is the proper portal for getting a hold of us. And if we don't know the answer to the question, we will certainly reach out to someplace that can get you the answer, maybe refer to you to the right refer you to the right spot. But we appreciate you joining us here on the Retirement and IRA Show. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.